It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we talk about equipping the kitchen. So what are the things you really can't live without? That's exactly the question we put to the pros. Food writer John Willoughby, master of wine Mary Ewing Mulligan, and kitchen designer Deborah Krasner. All are formidable cooks and all have surprises for us. Speaking of surprises, wait till you hear what our road food duo Jane and Michael Stern have to say about knives. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson reports on California's Rhone Rangers. We get the scoop on New York City's Donut Man, and we open the lines for your calls. All this coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's look at artichokes, how to buy them, how to handle them, and some artichoke cooking basics. Talk about a challenging food. I mean, let's face it, these guys are in the thistle family. Artichokes are not what you would call the most accessible vegetable in the produce aisle. In its raw state, the artichoke leaves are tough, they can have spines that prick, and you have to do some work to get to the edible part. But once there, the artichoke is pretty classy eating. Let's start with buying the artichoke. You want ones that are plump and heavy for their size. Their leaves should be tight to the body of the artichoke and look fresh and crisp, not dried out. Check for brown spots and press the bottoms. They should be firm, never soft. Now, if the artichoke has stems, check that they're not withered or black, a sure sign of over-the-hill artichokes. By the way, if the stems are plump and fresh, I usually peel them and cook them right with the artichokes. They're completely edible. Once you get your artichokes home, store them in the refrigerator in plastic bags that you've punched a lot of holes in. It lets a little air circulate. I sometimes trim away the bottom of the stems and then just put the artichokes in a little water to kind of plump them up. A couple of cooking tricks. Artichokes discolor easily, so whenever you cut them, rub the surface with half a lemon. Also, when simmering artichokes, make sure there's a lot of lemon or vinegar in the water. Learning all the ways you can eat an artichoke is like studying the art of striptease. The less that's there, the more exciting the artichoke gets. Now, here's how an artichoke breaks down. Each stage is good eating. Start with the whole thing. This is the simplest way to serve an artichoke. Trim away the top of each leaf, and use scissors to do this. A knife is a pain in the neck here. Then simmer the artichoke in lemon water about 20 minutes or until it's tender when you pierce the bottom with a knife. Serve it hot or cold with any dressing you like. To eat the artichoke, you remove the leaves, dip them in the dressing, and then to get the delicious meat at the base of the leaf, scrape it away with your teeth. When all the leaves are eaten, you see the fuzzy choke. Scrape that away with a spoon and discard it. Then eat the base of the artichoke with a knife and fork. And don't forget that stem. The next step is to make artichoke hearts. Again, start with the raw artichoke. Pull away those coarse outer leaves until you get to pale green ones. Then go right to the center of the artichoke and trim away the purple leaves and the fuzzy choke underneath them. Now you've got artichoke hearts. All this trimming is a breeze if you half the artichoke first. Just slice it in half. Artichoke hearts are wonderful, thin sliced, and eaten raw the way they do in Italy. Or you can marinate them, saute them, or roast them with herbs and olives. The last step of our striptease is the artichoke bottom. Now, if you trim away all the leaves of the raw artichoke and cut away that fuzzy choke, under that choke is the artichoke bottom. It's the filet mignon of the artichoke, meaty, thick, and delicious. It, too, takes to marinating, and it's a great pedestal for other foods like shrimp salad or stir fries. Okay, now that you know artichoke anatomy, let's take a quick look at which seasonings and foods go with artichokes. Artichokes love citrus flavors, lemon, orange, lime. They were made for the flavors of the Mediterranean. Think garlic, olives, fresh herbs, tomatoes, olive oil. Try this dish. Brown up some raw artichoke hearts with potatoes, onion, and tomato. Toss in garlic and olives and cumin. And then cook until tender. Serve it with couscous. Try artichokes in fish or artichokes in lamb. So, pick up some artichokes, do the artichoke striptease, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed is one of the largest bridal registries in the country, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today we are talking kitchen equipment. What do we really need in our kitchens? There's a lot of stuff out there, and it's really confusing. One way to educate ourselves is to go to the pros. So we've asked some of our favorite experts to answer this question. What are your favorite pieces of kitchen equipment? The ones you can't live without. The answers will come from Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan, award-winning food writer John Willoughby, and kitchen designer Deborah Krasner. And, of course, we can't leave out Jane and Michael Stern. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has a report on California's Rhone Rangers. There's a group of California winemakers who have started making wine with Rhone grapes. Now, Josh says that there's some great bargains to be had there. We hear about a guy in New York City who's nuts for donuts. We've all got our obsessions. And then, as always, the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So now let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, every week we talk to you about great places to eat all over the country, but do you two ever get time to stay home and just cook?
Yeah. I mean, people think all we do is live out of doggy bags or take home containers, but in fact, when we're not on the road, we are very, very passionate cooks and passionate buyers of kitchenware as well.
Oh, God. So you're collectors.
Collectors is kind of a grandiose word for, you know, drawers and shelves overflowing with every possible kind of thing, you know, that we, when we walk into a store, we can't resist. Yes, we're collectors, Lynn.
Are there pieces, though, you really don't want to be without?
I've given this a lot of thought. One of my favorite games is thinking, what would I run out of the house with if it caught on fire? And from the kitchen, there is one thing I would take. And that is my oldest cast iron skillet. We have a skillet that Jane and I have had really since we were married. It's been used for 1,000 pieces of ham, 1,000 burgers, 1,000 everything else. It's old, it's seasoned. And the thing is, most other pieces of cookware you can replace. This cannot be replaced.
Did you buy it new?
I guess we did. It's been so long, I don't remember ever buying it. It's always been part of our life.
One of our pans is from my mother, who used to use it for chicken liver.
Oh, so it was old when we got it.
Yeah, it was old.
What's
right.
Better
it's,
than that?
It's ancient. And I think my favorite things that I have to have are a really good cheese grater and a vegetable peeler. I'm a connoisseur of good vegetable peelers. I find that bad ones, I wind up sort of peeling carrots and then sort of peeling my fingers along with them. So I'm very fussy about vegetable peelers and am amazed that they stay sharp as long as they do.
Well, what makes a good one for you, that it stays sharp? Is it the handle? What is it?
Yeah, everything. Like, it's the whole gestalt of the vegetable peeler. But a big squishy handle is very nice. I can't stand the ones that have those little, you know, chintzy metal things, like pencil-sized handles that you hold onto.
What about the cheese grater? Do you like that kind of box kind?
I like every kind.
Oh, Jane and I have a real battle royale going about cheese grater. I mean, we each have our own. Jane
Michael
has the,
hides his cheese
I do.
Grater.
I do, because you don't clean yours properly.
Really?
Wow. Okay,
Jane has
I am so humiliated.
Jane prefers the boxy kind and has about four of those. I have one fabulous flat one that is so old. I mean, it really looks like an antique, but I just love it because I know exactly where to hold the cheese and how to press the cheese to get the exact size of cheese flakes that I want.
Michael is anal retentive, and he thinks I don't know this, but he has the cheese grater and his pound of coffee beans hidden where he thinks I don't know where they are, so I don't touch them. He could have his own stash.
It's obvious that I've touched a nerve here.
This is a very sore spot.
I think this is marital counseling coming up.
I think we should do is talk about knives. I mean, this leads me naturally to think about knives that we own. I was thinking about the knives that we have in the kitchen. Long ago, early in our marriage, we really thought long and hard about getting the best possible knives. We got a whole set of Henkel knives. I mean, the best German knives. We spent a fortune. I mean, it was then a real fortune on these knives. Subsequently, we were watching TV and actually got a set of Ginsu knives for $9.95 or whatever it was. And, you know, interestingly enough, we still have both and use both.
So you find both of them are working well for you then?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. I don't like you thinking about knives, Michael, when you're annoyed with my kitchen habits.
I think we're going to have to see if we can get a group rate from a marriage counselor. And in the meantime...
I do, too.
Thank you both.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
You're the pepperoni to my pizza pie. You're the caramel on the apple and the apple of my eye. I said I love you like E.
I love you like E.
I said I love you like E.
I love you like E.
I'll take a human help with your loving any day.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA, and you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Now, while you're visiting, pick up a copy of their book, autographed just for you. It's at the Splendid Table store. And in true public radio style, all the proceeds from the store go to support this very program.
Oh, baby, that tastes good.
Wine authority Joshua Wesson is something of a maverick. He believes we should treat wine as an everyday beverage, and he's got no problem selecting a wine to go with a Big Mac or a salad bar takeout. He's always looking for what's new and what's good sipping for modest money. Josh stops by regularly. Josh, hello.
Hello to you.
Josh, you've mentioned the Rhone Rangers quite a few times when you've been on the show. But you've never really explained what they were. So, come on, talk Rhone to me.
I will. I'll talk Rhone to you.
Okay.
Of course, everybody knows that the Rhone is a river, and it's in southern France. And the Rhone Valley is famous for lots of different kinds of wines, Châteauneuf du Pape, Hermitage, Côte Rôti. And back in the late 80s, there came to be this loose-knit confederation of California wine producers who loved those Rhone wines from France and decided to plant grapes that were grown in France in the Rhone Valley and try to make wines similar in style and taste. And now they're no longer loose-knit. They're actually tightly bound together in a collection of about 45 different wineries that extend not only in California but up the coast to Washington State, covering producers who grow these grapes and make wines in a Rhone style.
And are they, I mean, do they work? Is this possible?
Well, if you asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, you know, some of them work, but most of them don't, because either the vines are too young or there's not enough experience in planting grapes and making wines from these grapes or knowing where to put the different vines. But so much has changed in the past 10 years, and there's been a tremendous learning curve that these 45 different wineries that grow these grapes and make these Rhone-style wines are putting out some pretty good to absolutely amazing wines.
All right. You know what this is time for now. I want to hear your picks. What do you want us to try?
Well, you know, I think that Syrah is going to be the next Merlot. You heard it here, you know, maybe second or third, but, you know, there's some wonderful value-priced wines because the market isn't really clamoring for wines based on Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, for the most part. These wines are undervalued, in my opinion, and I'm going to give you a handful of reds and one white wine that is really surprising and incredibly delicious and not very costly.
Now, these are the grapes that generally would be used to make the Rhone wines.
Right. The workhorse grapes of the Rhone are Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, Sanceau, Carignan, and to a lesser extent, white grapes called Marsanne, Roussanne, and Viognier. Okay. And they're all grown in different parts of California and Washington, but I'm going to focus on a handful that I think are really special.
Okay, go for it.
McDowell Syrah coming out of Mendocino. Very supple, with soft tannins, lots of black cherry fruit, sells for about $10. Amazing, just amazing. And Rosenblum, coming from a different part of California down in Contra Costa County, makes a wine called Chateau La Paz, P-A-W-S. And there's a picture of a dog on the front, and it's actually called Côte de Beaune. Now, Côte de Beaune is a place in Burgundy, but this Côte de Beaune is made from Mourvèdre, and Beaune is spelled B-O-N-E. And it's really silky on the palate. It's got raspberries and currants and cinnamons. It's a really delicious bottle of red wine. The Phelps, Joseph Phelps folks in the Napa Valley make a blend called Pastiche, which consists of five or six different grapes, and they toss these grapes together and make a fabulous Côte du Rhône Châteauneuf du Pape style wine, which sells for about $10-$12, probably my absolute favorite of the three. And then there's a white that I want to throw in just for good measure. Viognier is one of the most difficult to cultivate white grapes in the world. It's grown in very small quantities in France up in the northern Rhone in a town called Condria. But if you get it into the Dunnigan Hills in California, R.H. Phillips makes an astounding Viognier for about $12, which will blow your mind with this wild mix of spice and peach and melon, and it'll get you off of that Chardonnay kick that you're on.
Well, now, are these wines that you can drink right away, or should you lay them down?
The great thing about Rhone Ranger wines is that they're usually good to go right out of the bottle. They don't require any time to lay down to mature because they're not harsh, they're not tannic, they're not overly structured. Even the wines that are high in alcohol can be enjoyed right from the bottle. They're great to drink.
Hey, Joshua, thank you.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can get Josh's wine picks on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, equipping your kitchen with the pros and your calls. Get on the line at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show devoted to life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at target.com. Equipping our kitchens. Seems easy. We go out, buy a set of pots, a few knives, some gadgets, maybe a bowl. Not much thought required, right? Well, maybe not so right. Maybe the pots scorch and the knives barely cut butter, and when we try to do that recipe we can't wait to eat, we find we don't have any of the essential tools. So this raises the question, what is really essential in a kitchen? What is the stuff we shouldn't live without? To find the answers, we went to the professionals, some of our regular contributors, starting with food writer John Willoughby. John is co-author of many cookbooks, including License to Grill, and he writes about cooking techniques for national publications like the New York Times and Martha Stewart Living. So I asked John, hey, what are the things you can't live without in your kitchen?
Well, I would say at the absolute top of my list, the one tool I would never cook without is my pair of spring-loaded heavy-duty tongs. Actually, I have about six pairs of them, and they are indispensable to me. Any time that you would like to do something with your hand, but you would burn it if you did, like reaching into boiling water to test pasta, or flipping over a pork chop in a pan or a piece of bacon, or pulling a roast out of a roasting pan, you can do it with these tongs. They're really like a hand that doesn't burn, completely indispensable.
Okay, so heavy-duty spring-loaded tongs.
And it's important they be spring-loaded so you don't have to flip them open. They just stay open for you.
And these aren't wildly expensive, are they?
Oh, no, they're like $5. They're incredible. They're just
great.
The best thing.
This
they are the
great.
Best. And the other thing that I really use all the time, I've been doing a lot of stewing and braising this winter, and my big old enameled steel Dutch oven, there's no substitute for it. It's even heat. You can cover it. You can take the cover off. You can put it in the oven. You can do it on top of the stove. It's the most versatile pan I own.
Enameled steel? Interesting. What's the brand on that?
Got me. it's the one that everybody knows.
Le Creuset?
Yes.
Oh, that's enamel cast iron.
And the cast iron,
ah,
right.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, no, but those are incredible.
Yeah.
Is there something that you really would love to have?
You know what I'd really like to have is I have a lot of roasting pans, but I would really love to have the giant all-clad aluminum roasting pan, which a friend of mine, actually Chris Schlesinger, my co-author, has one. And I don't have one because they're really expensive, but I would love to have one.
Okay. Well, we'll remember that, John.
Yeah, when Christmas comes around, Lynn.
I'll remember that, John.
You know where I am.
Okay. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
John Willoughby is co-author with Chris Schlesinger of License to Grill. Back to those enamel cast iron pots John mentioned, there's a trick you should know. Go for enameled cast iron, not cast steel, because I think the iron conducts heat better. For me, the best size is an oval 5-quart Dutch oven. You can do everything in it from a whole chicken to soup or stew. Thinking about that pot reminds me of this simple, simple lamb and potato casserole from southern Italy. I call it ninth night lamb because the woman who shared it with me didn't make it until the ninth night I stayed at her farm. She said it wasn't elegant enough for guests. It was just family food. Hey, this is wonderful stuff. This is all you do. You toss lamb with garlic, parsley, cheese, and tomatoes. You layer it with sliced potatoes and just bake it in that enameled cast iron pot. You can get the recipe on our website, splendidtable.org. It's called Ninth Night Lamb. Well, when you think about good eating, you have to think about wine. And that brings me to the first woman in America to earn the prestigious title Master of Wine. It's like a PhD in wine expertise. She's Mary Ewing Mulligan, co-author of the Wine for Dummies series of books, and one of our regulars. We spoke to Mary about what's essential in her kitchen.
Well, I couldn't cook without drinking wine. I couldn't eat without drinking wine. I love my Skrupul corkscrew. It's rather expensive. It's about $20, and it's made of plastic, so it does break now and then, unfortunately. But it's the kind that you fit over the top of the bottle, and you start turning it, and the screw goes in, and then the cork comes out, all in a continuous turning motion. And it's good for about 90% of the bottles that I open. It's my favorite corkscrew. And then, of course, after I open the bottles and after I drink a little wine, sometimes there's a little wine left over, mainly because I've opened two or three bottles. That's why there's wine left over in each of them. Not that I would fail to finish one bottle. But I just love my canister of private preserve. It's a combination of gases. I suppose there's some nitrogen in there, maybe a little bit of argon. And you spray it into the airspace of the bottle and then just put the cork back in. And it really keeps the bottles of wine, it keeps the wine very well preserved in the bottles for, sometimes 2 weeks. I'll open the bottle up afterwards, and I really won't be disappointed. It will be quite fresh still. So I really love that.
What about glassware?
I guess the ones that I use the most are the short-stemmed Riedel red and white wine tasting glasses. They have a normal size bowl, but a little tiny short stem so that they fit into the dishwasher very nicely. And those are the glasses that I use the most. But I've got a whole cabinet full of, burgundy-shaped glasses, Bordeaux-shaped glasses, smaller glasses for white wine, very large glasses for very special wines, etc. So on a given night, I could take out, three glasses for the same wine to see which one works best.
The luxury of being in the business.
Yeah, I know.
Mary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband, Ed McCarthy, of the Wine for Dummies series of books. Okay, on we go. We've got one more stop. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner always has a new but really practical take on how to make kitchens work better. So, what stuff does she need in her kitchen?
Well, the first thing that I love is having enough light to see what I'm doing and do it well. And for that, I need good task light that illuminates the work surface, and I like to have good atmospheric light so that when I want to make the kitchen fade into the background and the dining area come up, I can have lighting that really sets the stage in the dining area and makes it beautiful. So for atmospheric light, I like to use candles. I find pillar candles, candle chandeliers, candles on shelves to be just a beautiful way of making a good place to eat in the kitchen. But when I'm cooking, I want to have good light on that counter, and I want light that's not going to shift when I move and cast shadows on it. And what I find very useful are clip lights and lights that are portable that can be aimed and put in the kitchen exactly where they're needed.
So you walk around with clip lights and you clip them where you need them.
Well, I don't do it every day. Once I get them set, I leave them there. But it really makes a big difference.
Deb, I think of you as the queen of appliances.
What a title.
Yeah, well, you work with them all. What about a toaster?
Oh, gosh, Lynn, you know what happened? When I was writing my book about equipment, I got toasters from every single major appliance maker, and I lined them up on the counter, and every day we made toast, and every day we'd make toast in several different toasters to, to see which was faster, which was better. And they were endearing. There was one that sort of gently hugged your bread and slowly went down and then very gently and slowly came up with a discreet little ding. And then there was another one that sounded like a rocket launcher that went kapow every time your toast came out. And they all had, different kinds of qualities. But what ended up happening was within a very short time, like 4 to 6 months, they would start breaking. I couldn't believe the planned obsolescence in all of these toasters. And then I said, all right, enough with pop-up and pop-down toasters. And I did the same kind of cross-toasting with toaster ovens. And I found that they were much sturdier and really built to last. And among those toaster ovens, I had two favorites. The De'Longhi, which was Italian, was my first favorite. And the great thing about these toaster ovens is you can also bake in them, and they have a convection setting. And broil for toasted cheese.
Yeah, and you can heat up stuff in it, and it doesn't take a lot of space.
You can make a meatloaf in it. You can make a small chicken.
Yeah.
But my current favorite is the new Cuisinart toaster oven, which is big, but it's good looking and it does a beautiful job.
Is there anything else?
Finally, a food processor. In my kitchen at home now, I have two food processors. I have a KitchenAid and a Cuisinart in different sizes, and I use them every day.
This is great. Hey, thanks, Deborah.
Thank you.
So who knew all this about toasters? Deborah Krasner designs kitchens across the country. She's the author of Kitchens for Cooks. Now, for all of our pros tips, go to the Perennial website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open. Give us a call. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's talk. Anything goes. Let's get right to it. We've got Michael on the line. Michael, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about a way in which you can help improve my life by helping me figure out...
Michael, wait a minute. Hold it. I think you're calling the wrong person.
Oh, no. I've been wanting to eat more tofu recently and have been eating more tofu recently, and I'm looking for different ways to cook it other than ways that I've been cooking it.
Uh-huh. So you want to know what to do with tofu?
Yeah, basically what I've been doing, I don't particularly like the flavor. It's mostly neutral, but not particularly fond of that bean curd flavor. So usually what I've been doing is marinating it in something overnight, either a glass de viande or some kind of stock and something from the refrigerator door, and then frying it up, and that gets a little old.
Right.
And so I'm looking for something that would give it a little more oomph, something I would look forward to, that rather than saying I'm being virtuous and eating tofu.
Because it's going to get old real fast.
It is beginning to get old after a few months, yeah.
Well, you've sort of picked a sore subject, Michael. It seems a while ago I happened to mention in an aside that I thought that tofu was the worst thing that could have happened to a soybean, and it led to months of hate mail. I have never seen people so vehement on a subject. I mean, nuclear testing didn't draw this kind of vehemence. It was just amazing. But
well, it is good for you. It is a good thing to eat.
Absolutely. And I don't want to discourage you from eating it or anyone else. But I do have some tips for you. Because years and years and years ago, I taught Chinese cooking. And do you know that tofu has been around for 4,000 years?
Yes.
Now, I think it may be the same piece of tofu, but I'm not sure about that. But I think that if you go... I think the refrigerator door is always a good place to begin when you think about seasoning.
Right.
I'm with you on that. But, you know, it's a mainstay in China and in Japan. So if you turn to those cuisines, you're going to find an endless amount of things to do with it. Because the thing about tofu is it's a neutral. There's nothing about tofu that's all that wonderful. But the stuff you do to it or the stuff you eat with it is what brings it the character. Now, there's one thing. This is not healthy, though. I mean, the thing that always comes to mind when people say, what do you do with tofu, is this fabulous Chinese dish where you stuff it with stir-fried ground pork that's been cooked.
Wonderful.
Well, the pork is seasoned and spiced, and I don't remember the details, but I want to say a small amount of soy sauce, a little bit of sugar, diced water chestnut for crunch, maybe dry sherry.
And then bake it for a while?
No, you stir-fry it. In a little bit of oil.
Right.
Ground pork with those things until they're cooked.
Okay.
And then you take blocks of the tofu and you make a slit and you stuff it in.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then you deep fry it. Trust me.
Deep fried tofu. That is kind of a contradiction there.
I know, exactly. As your arteries are clogging, you're eating the stuff that's good for you. But there are some other things that you can do. For instance, especially the pressed tofu that doesn't fall apart very easily. You can do stir fries that have a lot of flavor, you know, using spicy seasonings, using seasonings that bring a great deal to the party. It might be oyster sauce. It might be hoisin sauce. And use the tofu. Like, for instance, are you familiar with the dish Kung Pao chicken?
Of course.
You know, it's that very spicy chicken.
In other words, use tofu instead of chicken.
Exactly. Because think about this. Chicken breast is neutral. Look at all the recipes in Chinese cooking that use chicken breast.
Of course, of course. So I can basically any recipe that uses chicken breast, as long as it's not whole, as long as it's cut up.
That's right.
Just adapt that to tofu.
Yeah, and use the pressed tofu because it just will hold up better in that. But I'd say start there. And also, any really reputable Chinese cookbook is going to have good tofu, and especially when you get into Chinese vegetarian cooking.
Well, the main advantage of eating a lot of tofu is after you've eaten a couple of servings of tofu, then you feel free to eat other kinds of things that you really enjoy.
Like that great pork chop.
Exactly. Once you've got your tofu in for the day, or a pound of tofu, then you're free to enjoy yourself.
Well, all right, there you are, you see? But it is very healthy, and I don't want to offend anyone, and I think you're on the right track.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Goodbye, Michael. We have Sonia calling. Sonia, what do you want to talk about?
Black walnuts.
Black walnuts?
Yes.
Where did this come from?
Well, from my father's yard. His black walnut tree, which really produced this year. My brother waited till they fell to the ground, picked 2 bushel of black walnuts.
Whoa.
Took off the green husk using a hammer before they became black so that the meat would not get dark. And then he peeled them with gloves on so that his hands wouldn't turn orange.
And fall off. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then around that husk was a fibrous substance. So he soaked them in water and agitated them against one another to remove that fibrous material. Some of them he had to brush with a nylon brush. Then he dried them under the stove. And my father, who is 80, has been sitting in front of the wood-burning stove, smashing them with a hammer on a metal strip of metal, and then picking the teeny-weeny bits of nut meat out for me. And he handed me about 2 cups, and he said, do something with these.
This is what you got out of 2 bushels.
Yes. Well, there's still more to go. He could do some more, but he wants to see, you know, a product for all this work. And he said, well, throw them in some cookies. And I don't want to do that. I mean, they have such a delicate flavor.
There's a couple of things. If you want to do something sweet, but first of all, what I never knew, this is the process you had to go through.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want a sweet? Because there's a savory thing you could do with them that could be great.
That's an idea I just never thought along the savory lines.
Well, there's a walnut sauce for pasta that is done in the Liguria region of northern Italy.
Oh.
But I'm thinking of a variation of it. This is where you pound the walnuts. I think there's garlic in it. I think there's some parsley. And then there's a little water from your pasta as it cooks. And ricotta cheese. But your walnuts are so special, and they seem to, I mean, after all that, I don't want to mass them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what would happen if you took a small amount of minced onion, sautéed it in a little bit of butter, cooked up some pasta, and I would do, you know, something like fettuccine, and you toasted the walnuts, coarsely chopped them. Toasting them because you'll bring up a lot of flavor, I think.
Uh-huh.
Light toast.
You do pine nuts.
Yes, exactly, but very light toast.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I would do is I would toss in the pan where the sautéed onion is the drained cooked pasta, the walnuts, and a small amount of cream with salt and pepper, and maybe just a little Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, because that tends to be a lifter of other flavors, and that would be the whole dish.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
I try that.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And it'd be something very different.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking sweet. You know, you think sweet, but that sounds wonderful.
Take a try.
I'll have to try that.
And I have great respect for all this effort.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, take care.
Mm-hmm, bye.
Goodbye. Okay, it's time for trivia, our weekly trivia question, and this week it has to be about kitchen equipment. Here's the question. What makes a sauté pan a sauté pan? Think about that. We're going to be back in a moment with the answer, a report on New York City's Donut Man, and more of your calls. So get to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252. But before going there, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, what exactly makes a sauté pan a sauté pan? The answer is, it's a shallow pan with straight sides. I said straight sides. The pans with slanted sides are called fry pans or skillets. It's a big distinction, and here's why. In a straight-sided pan, you get more flat cooking surface for your money, which means you've got more room to spread out pieces of food so they brown to perfect crispness. You see, when food touches, it doesn't brown. It tends to steam. The slanted sides of skillets and fry pans cut back on your cooking area. So this is why I think everyone should have a sauté pan. The other thing is the size of the pan. 12 inches is really the best. Now, you can use this for small or large quantities of food. I use mine practically every night. Most people ignore the size completely. They usually get a 10-inch pan, and I think they're missing out. Only a 12-inch sauté pan makes it easy for you to properly brown a cut-up chicken in one batch, or braise enough veggies for the whole family, or cook a quick tomato sauce for a whole pound of pasta. And one other thing about sauté pans, they double as great roasting pans. Just be sure the handle is totally heat-proof. So think big. Go after that 12-inch sauté pan with straight sides. You won't be sorry. Now let's get back to our calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's on the line. We have Jeff calling. Jeff, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my question is about how an unknown like me breaks into the cookbook market with a book that I've written about a bread recipe I've taken 12 years to develop.
So you've written the book.
I've written parts of it. I've written the master recipe, and I've written some of the variations. And I'll be a little bit immodest, and I'll say that it's a revolutionary concept. I'll go so far as to say that.
Okay.
And it produces, I guess I would describe them as artisan-style loaves, you know, European-style hard-crusted breads.
Ooh.
And it only takes about 5 minutes a day. So it's the same convenience and speed of a bread machine, but you can't get a good crust on those.
Well,
Jeff,
you're already marketing the book. There's I don't know how many million people listening, and they're probably sitting there and saying, "Gee, I really want to know about that." Okay, so you want to know how you go about marketing,
yeah.
You know, getting this cookbook to a publisher.
Right, especially since, you know, if somebody had the idea, if somebody had the basic nugget of the idea, they could easily recreate what I've done.
Maybe we shouldn't be talking about this on the air, Jeff. All right, this is the first thing you should do, and that is go to the library, and there is a publication of the name of which I cannot recall, but if you ask a librarian, they'll help you. There is a listing of literary agents.
Mm.
And you can take a look at that list, But and another thing you can do to figure out, because I think you should start out with an agent.
That's the question.
Yeah, because it just makes it easier to reach a publisher. And sometimes a really good agent becomes not only your advocate, but sometimes also helps you critique a proposal. Mm-hmm. And they will explain to you exactly how to do a proposal, because there's a form that a publishing proposal should take. And as my agent says, trust me, this can be an unnatural act. You know, but also there's a couple of good books out there. Literally, I think there's a book out there called How to Write a Cookbook.
Really?
That might be helpful. The other thing to do is look at books that are similar to the kind of thing you want to do.
Uh-huh.
See who publishes them and read the acknowledgments, because that's going to tell you, too, about who are the agents who are handling these authors.
Oh,
educate yourself about the kinds of books different publishers publish so you have a list in your mind of the publishers you think are right for your kind of book. And take a look at those acknowledgments to find out which editors are out there that are working with the kind of books you like and that you think are the style of book that you're doing and have the feel of the kind of book you want to do. Because those are people you want to go and market your book to, and an agent will help you. An agent is your advocate. It's like an attorney. An agent does also what you ask of them. The other thing is, don't worry about being rejected.
I assume it'll be mostly that.
Well, it may or may not be. You may also be very fortunate. But rejection is sometimes part of the game.
Sure.
And one other thing to consider, because it builds credibility in the eyes of a publisher that you're a saleable commodity and you know how to write, if there's any place in your area where you can start writing about food. You don't have to blow the whole cookbook.
Right.
You may want to take small parts of it that you've been mulling over and thinking about, and maybe it's a local newspaper. Aim at national magazines as well.
That's a great idea.
But start writing, because you can also then say to a publisher, well, look, you know, this. Not only do I have this proposal and samples of my work, but here's some examples of what I've done. So this, I think that should sort of launch you on your way.
Oh, great.
And the other thing down the line is test your recipes and test them again and again to make sure that someone who's never thought about what you've been thinking about for 20 years can really make them work.
Uh-huh.
So give it a shot.
Okay.
Hey.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Can't wait to see it in print.
Okay. Bye.
Goodbye, Jeff. You know, that starts me thinking about what makes a good cookbook. You may or may not agree with this, but I really think what makes a really good cookbook is someone who has a real passion as well as great expertise, which Jeff sounds like he has. But, you know, to have just another collection of recipes, you know, that's a snore. You can get that out of any magazine these days, and it's a lot cheaper. But to be able to get a sense from a book that there's a real person who cares and knows and wants to tell us, don't you think that's one of the things that makes a really good cookbook? The other thing is, I hate books where I sense people have not tested the recipe. Julia Child says your book is only as good as its worst recipe. And boy, you know, when you get one flop, that's one thing. When you get two flops, when you hit three, I want to toss the book out the window. Okay, let's get back to the phones. We've got Mary Jane on the line. Hey, Mary Jane, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I was calling because I have an assortment of old sesame oils in my cupboard.
You collect antique sesame
yes.
oil. I like it.
Yes, not intentionally, but just when I go through those periods of trying to make the perfect peanut sesame noodle dish for my husband, who loves them, never... spicy enough from the places that we go to eat, and occasionally I'll come across a recipe, and then I don't try it again for a year, and there sits an entire bottle of sesame oil, and I wondered what the shelf life on oils and some of these Chinese condiments that you use a pinch of is, because they're either I have the oyster sauce in the side of the refrigerator and the sesame oil up in the cupboard.
I think I still have a jar of fermented bean curd somewhere in my life, an open jar, from when I first did Chinese cooking in 1967. I'm convinced.
Well, it's just getting to Pittsburgh now, see, so that's why.
Yeah, well, you know, but trust me, I mean, this stuff goes on forever.
Yes.
The trick, you're talking about the Chinese sesame oil, right, which is
the
roasted sesame.
Yeah, well, it's... I've tried a number of different brands. This happened to be one. I was in a specialty grocery store, and this is what they had. It was something I'd never heard of. It's actually called Lorava, 100% pure extra virgin sesame oil supreme.
My, those little seeds have never been pressed before.
But it wasn't very flavorful, I have to tell you. It was too extra virgin or something. I don't know. But
pressed between the knees of virgins. This is exactly the way. Or ground under their heels.
Yes.
This is, and virgins who were not very spicy or interesting. The deal with this, with a lot of oils, the average oil that you buy, especially if it's cold pressed as opposed to hydrogenated, you know, these hydrogenated oils you buy in the supermarket, they'll keep about a year maybe, but I don't like them. I don't like them because they've already been treated with heat, and that knocks out a lot of the nutrients. So cold pressed oils are much more fragile. And except for olive oil, generally you want to refrigerate cold pressed oils once you open
it.
Yeah. And I would say most oils have a life of about a year. But the hard thing is with a lot of these, you don't know when they were pressed.
Right.
So what you have to do is trust your taste. Take a little taste of the oil and count to 10 after you swallow. Because if it's stale or musty, sometimes you don't taste it right away, but you get it in the aftertaste.
I see. Okay.
So trust your palate. And figure when you buy it, it's got 6 months to a year to go. As far as the sauces go, like the oyster sauce and that kind of thing, I think I always stick things in the fridge, which is, by the way, why you cannot fit any fresh food in my fridge, because every condiment in the world is there. My husband said one day he's expecting to find the dust mop, but that's beside the point. But the thing about oyster sauce, I have to tell you, I have kept oyster sauce up to 2 years in the refrigerator and can taste nothing that's untoward about it. But I think one of the things, if you ever see mold, you ever get an off aroma, if you have any doubt at all, do not taste. Just toss it.
Especially with the word oyster in it.
Well, I don't know that there really is. If there's oyster in there,
right.
It's pickled and,
yes.
You know, fermented and drained and, you know, it has stuff. I don't think the oyster is going to be suffering and causing any problems. But I think that's the basic idea.
Okay, thank you. Really enjoy the show.
Thank you for calling.
Okay.
And thanks for the kind words.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. We're out of time for calls today. Hey, thanks to everybody who joined in. Remember, our answering machine gets lonely, so call us anytime at 800-537-5252. I'm not quite sure what American food trends say about where we are as a nation, but they certainly do ebb and flow. It takes a lot to keep up. Take the donut. Shunned during the 80s and 90s when croissants were king, and now at the cutting edge of hipness thanks to the film industry's obsession with Krispy Kremes. I have an insider tip for you. The next big thing is the donut plant. Producer Annie Chaney has a report.
At 9 o'clock on a chilly Sunday morning in New York, there's already a line forming at Mark Israel's donut plant. Mr. Israel, who's known as the donut guy by his devoted followers, has been up all night hand-cutting his all-natural donuts, and his customers are anxious to get their hands on one.
There's something about the flavor that is addictive.
They're beefy. In a way that other donuts are fluffy.
It's like the way he cooks them. I mean, the amount of yeast in the batter and the fact that he overcooks the donuts just slightly, it gives them a really good caramelized taste.
That's not the only thing that makes these donuts stand out. Mark uses only organic and all-natural ingredients in his recipe, and his donuts do taste substantial, almost good for you, like hunks of sweet, lightly fried bread. They come in exotic flavors like ginger, pumpkin, and Tahitian vanilla. Savour magazine rated them one of the 6 best donuts in the country. Krispy Kreme wasn't on the list.
Now, Krispy Kreme is like the Hostess ding-dong, you know? It's just, it has like a much more mass market appeal. This is much more upscale, more delicious. I mean,
you know, if you're going to have chocolate, why have Hershey's when you could have Toblerone?
But you'll have to pay for it. Mark's donuts aren't cheap. They sell for about $2 each. Despite their expensive price tag and high-class status, these donuts had remarkably humble beginnings. 7 years ago, Mark was slaving in wholesale bakeries and barely able to pay his rent. Then one day, he decided to try some baking of his own.
I just went to a coffee shop, and I asked them if I made something for the coffee shop, would they buy it from me? And they said, well, what would you make? And I said, well, I could make buttermilk biscuits, which is something that I used to make for my friends, or I could make donuts. So I went home, I called my dad, and I got the donut recipe, on the phone, and I made the donuts in the morning. My apartment was a disaster. There was like flour on the floor and glaze on the floor, and you know, I didn't know anything. I taught myself how to make these donuts. I took the donuts to the coffee shop in the morning after I finished them, and the manager bought them on the spot. And then like an hour later, he called me and told me they had sold out and that he wanted them again the next morning.
Mark was soon selling to gourmet food stores like Dean and DeLuca and Zabar's, but his success didn't come without sacrifice.
After I saw that they were selling, I was like, well, I can't do this in my apartment anymore because it was such a mess. I couldn't live. So my landlord offered me a room in one of his buildings in the basement. It was like a jail cell.
For 5 years, Mark worked almost around the clock perfecting his donuts in that boiler room.
But what kept me doing it was that I had nothing else. It was either make a go at my bakery or go work for somebody else. And the thought of working for somebody else was just worse than even the worst day that I was having working on my own in the bakery.
With help from his brother, Mark was finally able to open the new donut plant this year, which is fully equipped with windows and state-of-the-art equipment. He also took his first vacation and went to Mexico. Even there, he couldn't get donuts off his mind. He spent most of his time in bakeries learning how to make churros, a local sugar-dipped donut, which he started baking at his store. Someday, he says, he'd like to make authentic donuts from around the world. Judging from these churros, America might just be in for a donut revolution.
Sugar, I get my taffy from sugar. What's more, I'm taffy by sugar. That sugar, baby, that sugar, baby of mine.
That piece was produced for us by Annie Chaney. You can get information on Mark Israel's donut plant on our website at splendidtable.org. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening, and remember, you can call us anytime, day or night. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and let me leave you with a thought from Calvin Trillin. Health food makes me sick. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from freezer to oven to the dinner table. To get a copy of the Stearns Roadside Food Finds and information on any of the other guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.